You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 80. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Tricorder Transmissions, everybody. This is episode number 80, the first episode after the close of the original series. Today, we're going to be talking through The Cage, and as always, we are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen. And as we said, this was our sort of surprise episode, and I don't think a lot of people are shocked that we're doing The Cage, but for the first time ever, for the entire duration of our episode, we're going to have a special guest. Jeff, you want to bring him on?
Absolutely. So, I don't think our coverage of The Cage would be complete without the creator of the Susan Oliver documentary, The Green Girl, Mr. George Pappy Jr. Welcome back to the show, George.
Hi, guys. It's great to be back.
So how does it feel to be the first ever third chair on a Tricorder Transmissions commentary?
That's a tremendous honor, especially when you summarize how many previous episodes there were. I feel like I really have gone almost where no other man other than you two have gone before.
That's a good way to put it.
We've really been looking forward to this, George.
Oh, me too. Me too.
I know that I think we started talking about this recording back at the convention last July, August, when we met up with you out there in Las Vegas.
That sounds right. Yeah. I remember thinking this is going to be fun. You know, it's such a fun episode, and you guys are fun to talk to anyway, so it's kind of like the best of all worlds.
That's pretty cool of you to say thank you. And, you know, George, the last time we talked to you on the show was during our Leonard Nimoy tribute episode, so we wanted to give you a quick chance to tell the audience what's happened with the Green Girl project between then and now.
Yeah, well, that was in February, I believe, and I guess in March and again in April, we appeared at two more film festivals here in the Los Angeles area. The first of those, I was really honored we even got in because it was a women filmmakers festival, and for the most part, it was all women filmmakers. I think they gave the Green Girl a slot, even though I was a director, because it's about Susan Oliver and was a very strong women's story, and we had a woman editor, so that was a real honor. And then in April, we appeared at the first Glance Film Festival in downtown LA, and we actually won the Best Documentary Feature Award. That's the second time we've won a festival feature award for the movie. So that was really nice, too. So other than that, you know, just continue the online sales. It's available on almost all the popular streaming platforms, iTunes, you know, Amazon Instant, Google Play, Xbox, Vudu, and the DVD. I sell the DVD. I've pretty much transitioned entirely to selling the DVD on Amazon now, just because they have a very efficient operation, and I didn't see the point in selling it. But we sell a handful of DVDs, a week, and surprisingly, all over the world. I mean, I've had people from France, Germany, New Zealand, Australia, Britain. So it's kind of heartening. I think even Italy. So it's kind of heartening to see who finds out and how they find out. I have no idea how they find out, to be honest with you.
That is excellent.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And congratulations again on those awards. That, you know, we've said it on the show many times, but they're very, very well deserved. And if anybody out there is interested, you really should give this movie a watch, because I remember sitting in the theater and watching it, the screening in Vegas last year at the convention, and walking away feeling like I learned so much more than I had known about Susan Oliver. So it was very, very well done.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it meant a lot that you guys were there. That was a very special screening. As you know, we had some people that were even in the movie, including Larry Nemechek and Celeste Yarnall. So
yeah,
that was a very fun memory of that. So thank you.
Oh, of course. It was our pleasure.
Of course. So, George, are you ready to join us on our journey through The Cage?
I am. Our transporter is standing by.
Great.
And I don't have Mr. Kyle either. I got Scotty on the console. We can't risk Mr. Kyle, who will get to it eventually. That, no way. Not for this.
Too important a mission for that.
That's right.
All right. So, The Cage originally aired on October 4th of 1988 with a great intro from Gene Roddenberry, which is actually still available on YouTube. So I'll make sure I link that in the show notes. And we got a remastered version on May 2nd of 2009.
All right. And the plot is, while investigating a distress call from Talos IV, Captain Christopher Pike of the Starship Enterprise is captured and tested by beings who can project powerfully realistic illusions.
All right, so we will get started with our scene-specific commentary on The Cage in 3, 2, 1.
So I think the first thing we need to talk about with The Cage is where it sort of fits into Trek history now, because it was sort of picked apart, if you will, or cannibalized for the Menagerie 1 and 2.
Correct. So there is no star date. No official star date for this. So it's a little bit tough to figure out where it fit in relation to the rest of the episodes in the series. But all we know is that it was quite a number of years prior to Kirk taking over command of the ship.
Now, George, how does this episode sit for you in terms of, is it more of just a standalone, like almost short film version of an alternate Trek, if you will?
Yeah, I've always kind of viewed it, when you take it out of the context of the Menagerie, I've kind of viewed it as a crude, rough proof of concept, which still had, in my opinion, a lot of flaws that they really, really ironed out by the time they got to the second pilot. And then between the second pilot and the actual series, they'd done even further ironing. So, you know, and I've always said it, I hope it doesn't offend any hardcore Trekkies, but I don't believe we'd all be sitting here talking about this show or this series, you know, 50 years later, if it had been this configuration of Star Trek. I don't think they quite had it. They had most of it, but there was still a lot missing, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's one of those
cats.
Yeah, it's one of those cases, George, where it really was a thing where they were forced to make those improvements.
Yes, like painting the railing red instead of black.
Now,
the
a major difference right off the bat is the Spock character, and not only is he physically look different here, but his delivery is different as well.
Yeah, I've always figured, and you know, I think it's pretty clear in this, he's just another guy who happens to have pointy ears. There's none of this concept of him. You know, he's obviously an alien, but there's none of this Vulcan stoicism that hasn't been developed. And I believe he said in interviews, he said over the years that he even felt compelled to play it a bit over the top because Jeffrey Hunter, who played Captain Pike, was such an internal actor. He wasn't like Kirk. Kirk, you know, Jim Shatner's over the top.
Yeah.
So it forced Spock, you know, even with this stoic thing, to feel like, you know, Nimoy felt he had to play it down even more against Kirk, whereas he felt the opposite with this guy.
Right. I love the swipe motion. It's almost a hint of what was to come with our smartphones and swipe technology.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
That it's something that didn't survive into the series proper, that those gesture controls for view screens on the ship. From now, after this, he has to press buttons to change views
right
on the screen.
By the way, how do you like that? How do you like this? The 50s attire when they're not on duty? Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah, like the non-uniformed people kind of wandering the halls of the Enterprise.
Right. And here we have an communicator.
And apparently they had no concept of an intercom system. And this is my favorite part, the giant entertainment center and the bed that's a foot too short for him.
Yeah, and no funky sheets. Craig always loves Captain Kirk's bed sheets, but Pike doesn't have them.
Yeah.
So here's our doctor for this episode. It's Dr. Boyce, played by John Hoyt, who died in 1991 at the age of 85, and he was a Broadway film and TV actor.
Yeah, he was a real veteran, and he's a great actor, but I got to say, this character that he plays, I've always felt he's straight out of Central Casting, you know?
Yeah.
This doctor. I mean, and you get to McCoy, and it's another one of those wonderful things that they, yeah, let's really dig deep with the character, but they're not doing that here, I don't feel.
No, so, and this is also really Exposition 101.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, if you really pay attention to this scene, there are shades of the McCoy to come, as it were. So you have, you know, not only the boozer doctor, but you also have the counselor. And, you know, McCoy was always counseling Kirk on what his next move could be or how he could deal with situations. And, you know, we're seeing that here as well. So, you know, as the character of Dr. Boyce may not be as dynamic as DeForest Kelly was, as Dr. McCoy, I think at least there's the beginnings of what the doctor would become.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And the one line that always stuck out of me in the scene is, man will tell his bartender things he'll never tell his doctor. You know? It's kind of like the subtext of the whole scene in a way.
Yeah. And then we get an indication here that this is a smaller enterprise because he talks about being responsible for 203 lives.
Yes, money less, right. Less than half of the Enterprise. The 430 crewmen on the Enterprise.
Right.
So, but I like this scene because it really shows sort of the, probably the universal thoughts that any starship captain would have.
Perhaps.
That's true. Yeah. Of course, you're also getting the recap of so here's all the illusions he's going to have later.
Yeah,
that is true. But, you know, I was thinking to myself earlier when I was getting ready to sit down with you guys, what would this episode have been like if this was Shatner instead of Jeffrey Hunter? You know, the Kirk character rather than the Pike character. I don't know if Kirk would have gone through this deep state of depression, talking about resigning. I mean, Kirk's been down before, but he's never really talked about quitting in my memory.
Right. Right. Yeah. In fact, he's the opposite. I mean, you think of the episode with Jill Ireland, where it's just tearing him apart so much that he has to quit, that he pulls him, you know, it pulls him out of the spell, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think he actually gets hit with the spores in that, but the love, you know, isn't that true? Or am I mixing up that with Naked Time?
No,
but it's a recurring.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say Jill Ireland was on the, what is it, This Side of Paradise?
The
Paradise Syndrome?
Didn't he get hit with the spores? Didn't he get hit with the spores in that? But his love of the Enterprise and passion for it overruled the spores.
Yeah.
And so that's how anti-retirement Kirk is, you know.
Yeah.
So, I'm agreeing with you that you really wouldn't see him doing this. I love this, by the way. I think it's very clever the way the I love these messages and they drop off and there's a second message, but in less, you know, .. That's kind of clever. I like this. However, I think this is the most excruciating scene we're coming up on here. The passage through space time lapse sequence.
Yeah.
Where they stand there staring at the screen, because that's exactly what they would do for like 18 hours till they get to the place, right?
Yeah. Is this supposed to be the warp effect? We're supposed to be seeing what
and
the ship is going through.
Especially Daria here miming
the
seven or whatever, because he can't say it to him because we can't hear him say it, right?
Yes. Yeah. Time warp factor seven, by the way. Yeah. Not warp factor, time warp factor seven.
So see, this to me is one of those things I think they watched in the screening room and they said, no, we're never doing this again if we get another chance. Good. Well, in fact, that's one of the great things they did on Star Trek once the series got rolling is there was all kinds of time for other scenes to happen on the ship while they're going wherever they're going to go for the next major development. And they didn't take advantage of that so much here. As they could have.
Do you guys think Pike is a little too menacing here with this young female yeoman? He just seems to be so angry.
Yeah, and a little shockingly sexist, considering we're supposed to be a few, you know, centuries in the future. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
I know she was terribly disappointed. The woman that played the yeoman there, Laurel Goodwin, I believe it was. She has said in interviews before that she was sitting around waiting anxiously for the pickup, and then got the good news, as did Peter Duryea and some of the others, that they would not be part of the pickup.
Yeah. But,
you know, I mean, it was the difference between, I think acting kind of ended for her after that. She'd been an Elvis girl before that. It's between, I mean, she would have been like Uhura or one of the other Trek regulars. But
yeah, potentially.
You know, it was a difference between an ongoing TV career and let's find something else to do.
Yeah, she could have been Same Janice Rand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully she wouldn't have been canned after six episodes, whatever the real story was there. Yeah. So.
I was just going to say really quick, speaking of things that didn't make it from the pilot into the series proper, is all this paper. There's paper everywhere. Everybody's handling paper. It's printing out of the consoles and, you know, there's clipboards with paper on them. And I guess Roddenberry's vision for the future, of course, included all electronic devices. So I think the only time we ever see paper again is when we get Kirk's super secret ship itinerary out of the safe in his room, right?
Right. What do you think about the beam down jackets and full packs and kits, including that mega backpack with the antenna?
There's a beer
fridge. Jackets. I like the jackets.
I do like the jackets.
Those almost, do those seem like that is something that Enterprise was inspired by?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Huh.
Definitely. Because those look almost like primitive versions of the Enterprise outfits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. You notice how long the beam down takes too in this? I was wondering if they exaggerated this for the pilot factor and trying to get the wow factor of the special effects from the network watching it.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to take forever from the beam down.
I also like how the crew cut guy cued the other guy. You know, it's like a two-man operation, carefully coordinated. You know, a lot more theater to the effect. Probably, like you said, because it's new.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, we need to exaggerate the effect so as if it's something that's complicated and difficult to pull off. But
I've always been shocked that they include. By the way, you see Nimoy limping there, which has been a mistake, and I used to think that he was just hurt when they shot it, but it's just a poorly executed or not really sufficiently supported carryover to what we already know, that the fight on Rigel 12 or whatever that planet was, he got hurt, right?
Oh,
that's why he was asking. That's why Pike was asking on the bridge, are you up to it?
Oh.
He goes, of course, sir. So that, and this is the most embarrassing thing in the world. I'm surprised this made it into the menagerie.
The musical plant.
The non-stoic, well, when he smiles.
Yes, the smiling Spock.
This is the non-stoic Spock, you know.
You know what I'm wondering there, though? I'm wondering if there was some kind of effect that flora generated.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, nice one. Yeah, there you go.
That's me trying to give Spock an excuse.
Yeah, that's like the sports. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, I'll buy that. Yeah. This guy, by the way, in the foreground that notices, he's the same guy in The Enemy Within that gets covered with the ore and beams up and causes the transporter malfunction.
Oh wow. Yeah.
So they gave him a consolation. He wasn't going to be a series regular, but they at least felt bad enough to give him an episode in one of the first episodes.
Yeah, and here we have another actor who returned.
I've touched the sky or whatever that. The world is hollow and I've touched the sky, and he did some other stuff too, didn't he?
And I think the return of the Archons.
Yes, yes.
Yes. You are correct.
Yeah.
That is actor John Lormer. Died in 1986 at the age of 79.
This is one of the best entrances ever with the music. It's just wonderful.
And look at those eyes, George.
Yeah. Just piercing. Pure blue.
Very piercing.
Yeah. As I've said in interviews before, and really we paint the picture in the documentary, The Green Girl, she was the obvious choice for this role in 1964. She was the guest star of guest stars, female guest star of guest stars. Like, super gorgeous, amazing actress. And she says in her autobiography that Roddenberry approached her at the MGM lot and tried to sell her real hard on this. I know it's been documented that Roddenberry had a list of actresses, including Barbara Eden and I think Yvonne Craig, but he was known to do things like that just to get the network off his back. I think there's a lot of evidence that he really wanted her. He was quite aware of her. She'd been in other things he'd written for other TV shows before.
Yeah.
And I think she carries, it's one of the problems I've always said with this cast. I think the network looks at it and she's really the best actor in this episode to me.
Oh, without a doubt.
That's a little bit of a problem when that she's not going to be back and that rest of that cast is the ones they're going to be tuning into every week. You know, you don't really necessarily want your guest stars to outshine your series regulars, and she does. So.
Yeah, and I mean, she's given so much to do there. I mean, I'd imagine that everybody on set was probably envious of the fact that she got to sort of play multiple versions of this person or, you know, play out these different scenarios.
You know, I don't know if I told you guys, last summer, I think it was after the Star Trek convention, I had a screening down here in El Segundo, which is near LAX. What's his name? Why am I drawing a blank on his last name? Not Mark Daniels, the other guy. The direction of the guy who directed this episode.
Robert Butler.
Robert Butler came to the screening, and I had him up on the stage. He's like 86 or something.
Yeah.
And he kept going, God bless your ass. God bless your ass. He was so happy that I made this. And I asked him to talk for a couple minutes, and he said he was a green director at the time. It was early on in his career as a director. He had worked his way up from like a page at the CBS studios.
Right.
He's really literally started at the bottom of this industry. He said his recollection was that he didn't really talk about the performance or the role with her at all. She just showed up with this performance. It was all her.
Wow.
They didn't discuss this. You know, it was TV, it was fast, and she just brought it. They didn't really talk about it.
that's amazing. And to talk about Robert Butler real quick, he sort of became the pilot king. He also directed the pilots for Hogan's Heroes, Batman, Hill Street Blues, Moonlighting, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and Remington Steel, which he also co-created.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, that's what he became known as a pilot director, which is an important role, especially for something groundbreaking like Hill Street Blues, because it's the pilot director who establishes the look and feel of a series. I love this shot, by the way, the wind blowing off their hair, especially Duryea's. I always thought that was a wonderful attention to detail. I assume it's the wind coming off the phaser blast. But Butler was a big deal. His son told me, by the way, that someone wrote a graduate dissertation on Remington Steele as some kind of a model of feminist kind of equality.
Really?
Remington Steele and Stephanie, what's her name on? Zimbalist, Stephanie Zimbalist, Efren Zimbalist Jr.'s daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised by that. That someone thought that was PhD dissertation worthy. So, but that guy, the old guy's still alive and kicking, you know? It was really a treat to have him be there for that and react to the documentary this way. Yeah.
And that was something you didn't know about until you got to the screening?
Yeah, well, it's funny. His son went to the same college as me. I'd met his son at a college reunion, but I didn't realize at the time that it was the same, that was the connection. I didn't know his father was Robert Butler, the director.
Right.
And then when he found out about The Green Girl, he contacted me. He said, oh, my dad directed that. So, yeah, pretty
That's
amazing.
Awesome.
I guess there's some interesting footage here of some of the other creatures in the cage that this stuff didn't make the menagerie cut. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe partly because some of it's a little, that's not quite up to standard, like the Birdman.
Mm-hmm.
Although they do have the trippy sort of slowed down effect on the Birdman, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know,
this was, go ahead.
George, I was going to say just really quick, getting back to Susan Oliver's career, you know, we know that it's very long and very varied, but one thing that I thought was a very cool coincidence is that in 1960, she was in a Twilight Zone episode called People Are Alike All Over, in about a rocket that goes to Mars and crashes. and the one male survivor winds up in a zoo, referred to as a human creature, which I thought was a really cool, strange coincidence parallel to this episode that she wound up in a few years later.
You know, you reminded me, I'd forgotten about this. There's this guy, he's got a blog. He's out of New Jersey. I tried to interview him when I was out there a few years ago doing some of the interviews, and we couldn't hook up. He's got some really trippy, long blog article about her and some theory involving Gnosticism, you know, G-O-N-O-S-T-I-C-I-S-M, Gnosticism, and her in all this stuff involving bars and cages. And he makes the parallel you just drew, plus all these other movies and TV shows.
Wow.
Where she's shown a lot behind bars, even things like in promo posters for like the Jerry Lewis movie she was in 64, her behind a brass bed frame, you know, peering through the bars. And just, I don't know. I don't know what it meant, but I thought it would be interesting to get this guy to talk about it for a few minutes. I just never got him, unfortunately.
Wow. We're going to have to look that up. That sounds very interesting.
Yeah. And he talks in this article about how Roddenberry was paying very close attention to what the guys on Outer Limits had been doing. In fact, some of those creatures we saw, the Birdman, might even come from Outer Limits. I can't remember exactly, but he draws some parallels between the cage and some stuff on the Outer Limits. And certainly some of these sound effects and things, you know, they were borrowing stuff from Outer Limits, I think. I've heard some of the same stuff. And a lot of the same actors, obviously, were in both.
Oh, sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah.
So I always love the makeup, the effect on the Talosian heads with the pulsating veins. I thought that was a really awesome effect for a television pilot.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to do that type of a makeup job for something that may never get seen by the general public.
Oh, yeah, especially if you consider people back then were watching it on smaller screens, and some people probably even in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I then, of course, the lead, the zookeeper, is Meg Willey, who was a Wiley. I don't know how you pronounce it, but she was a veteran character actress. I just thought that must have been a fascinating role for her to take on, probably unlike anything else she'd ever done.
Yeah.
You know, she often would play the store clerk or the librarian, those kind of roles. And then I'm going to put this thing on your head that pulsates and you're like this alien. That's kind of cool and different, you know?
Yeah.
So,
you know, but they dubbed all those voices, correct?
They did. In fact, the original voice in this version of the cage is deep voiced. It's not the same as the voice in the Menagerie. The reason is the voice of the zookeeper in the original is Malachi Throne, who was most well known, I think, as Reuben, Al Mundy's boss in It Takes a Thief. But he was also Commander Mendez when they shot the Menagerie. So they got the same guy. They didn't want his voice also to be the zookeeper, so they dubbed in a new higher pitched voice when they reused this footage in the Menagerie. But that's his voice in this version.
Oh, very cool.
I like that police sketch of the Talosian.
Yeah,
that's a pretty impressive quick turnaround, considering they just got that brief glimpse of him being dragged in by two of them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They got our artists right on that, you know?
You know, something that I really love about this boardroom scene is that they all kind of look to number one, the female character here, for the final decision on what they're going to do. And, you know, that back in the days when this was made, having a female call the shots like that is very, very progressive. And I think it's a really great indication of where Gene Roddenberry intended to go with this show. And there's a comment that he made in the interview that he did for that they tacked on the beginning of this when they aired it on television in 1988, where he speaks about the test audience that they screened this to, and how he was surprised that the women in the test audience didn't side with number one. In fact, they were offended by the fact that she was calling the shots. They were, you know, reactions like, oh, who does she think she is? And things like that. And it was amazing at the time how, you know, Gene was going to use this television show to pioneer some of his progressive views.
Right. And I've seen that kind of thing before. I remember being shocked once about 25 years ago with some women I worked with, and they said something like, I wouldn't want a woman to be president. You're just shocked when you hear that, but it is what it is, and it, especially along. There's, I want to rip aside here. She does this weird expression right here in frustration. I don't know what it is. I've always wondered, but I love it. Like, he's like not quite getting it, and she gives him this, and then she turns and runs away. I don't know what it is. Let's see. It's not quite, let's see. About to do it.
Some great intensity though from her. I mean, she steals just about every scene she's in.
Totally.
There you go.
Oh, there it is.
Look at this thing. That's like, with that
little scream.
Wink of the eye and she runs.
Even
as a little boy, that I'm like, that's weird. What's that? You know.
Well, the other thing I like about this sequence is you don't have really the standard damsel in distress here.
That's true. She's very much telling him what to do and fighting for herself when he's temporarily incapacitated. Yeah, yeah. That's all very true.
Mm-hmm. I would like to see this big baddie versus the Gorn. What do you think, Jeff?
I think the Gorn could take him.
He's quick, Gorn, though, this guy.
He is, but I think the Gorn, you know, slow and steady wins the race, man.
Barring hollowed out bamboo and all the elements of gunpowder, the Gorn wins.
Back out real quick here once and talk about the, however people are watching this episode, Craig and I know are watching this on Blu-ray. And I have to say, for a pilot episode, the restoration of this is absolutely gorgeous. The color is gorgeous. The sharpness is incredible. I mean, it's difficult to believe that this was a pilot shot in the early to mid '60s. It's just absolutely spectacular.
Two things about that. Number one, this was the most expensive pilot ever made at the time in television history, and I don't know how it would stack up if you inflation adjusted. I mean, obviously you have very slick productions in cable now, but in that era, this was by far the most expensive pilot ever shot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's wonderful that they got this, because you had mentioned that the original, I remember the original version of this came out in 88 finally. That was a mishmash cut together of, they had well-preserved copies of anything that was in the Menagerie two-parter, because that had been preserved along with the Star Trek episode. But the stuff that didn't make the Menagerie, it was old 16mm black and white print that Roddenberry had owned.
Wow.
So that 1988 version, I don't know if you've ever seen it, it goes back and forth between color and reasonably good looking and black and white and not so good looking. So it was a major find. I guess somewhere they dug up a pristine copy sometime many years later. And that's, thank God, because we have this as a result.
Yeah.
So I was saying, I remember seeing this in 1988 when it originally aired and being kind of confused by it, but amazed at the same time.
Oh, I was going to say, we were talking about the sexism thing before, lack of it.
Yeah, there was this alternate Star Trek that you'd never seen before.
Yeah. Well, there's that knife shot into the back, and now here's the spear dive. I love this.
I mean, any scene of that you'd never seen before, that was wonderful.
And there's more dramatic acting by Susan Oliver yet again.
Mm-hmm.
So spectacular stuff.
I bet that knife in his back, I've seen that in other episodes. Haven't you seen that knife in his back in other episodes, I think? They would reuse a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very similar. And all of a sudden, we're back in the cage again.
I love this here, when she suddenly realizes they're being watched.
Yeah, and she almost looks ashamed.
She pulls it. Yeah.
Yeah, so a little bit of expose is going to happen.
It's like when she realizes. Yeah, yeah.
So we don't know if she's actually real or not. We're as confused as Captain Pike at this point in the episode.
Do you guys think that one of the problems with this pilot episode was how isolated the captain was and how little of the ship we actually and the crew we get to see, George?
I never really thought about that. Maybe so. Just this captain, I didn't find him that interesting. I feel like he played this a lot by the book. this is how you'd expect a captain in a sci-fi series like this in the 50s or 60s to play it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think is so wonderful about Shatner. He's just so out of left field. It's wonderful. She just had a line there, by the way, and I put it in the documentary because I love it so much. It's a line that they didn't put in the Menagerie. I think they cut around it because they were worried about censorship. But when you say, "Oh, and dressed you in the same metal fabric they wear," and she says, "Well, I had to wear something, don't I?" You know,
it's very that was considered
pushing the line too far in 1966 when they had the Menagerie out. But yeah. I love that.
It's suggestive, yeah.
Yeah, Jeff, do you think, in terms of the pilot, do you think that one of the things that makes this a little less effective is the fact that we spend so much time with just Pike? And if you're sort of selling the show as a wagon train to the stars, you're not really getting that in this episode.
No, and actually Roddenberry himself makes mention of that as well in that little interview intro that I was mentioning prior. He even says that he promised Wagon Train to the Stars and the studio got something very, very different, which is true. But even in that respect, though, I can't help but think if Shatner was in this episode, I think it would have played much, much better. If it was Kirk.
Time with Shatner, right?
Yeah, I think he could have, because like you watch this and the scenes with Susan Oliver are very, very good and she's excellent, but Jeffrey Hunter, unfortunately, is very stiff. And I think that if it was the dynamic Kirk character in this, it would, even with this other crew members, without, you know, the other regular members, I still think it would have played off a heck of a lot better than it does.
Right. Majel Barrett makes a little mistake here, by the way. I love this, the phaser cannon, but watch what she does when they're straining. They never brought this back, the idea that they can channel the ship's engine power straight, beam it down to this thing, which is, I think, what the idea of this cannon is.
Yeah.
Look what she does when they're straining the engine. She doesn't speak into the communicator. She looks up at the sky and yells at them to stop.
Great observation. I didn't notice that before.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, that's one of those, you know, people that have watched it 50 times comment on these things. It's nothing original. I love that attention to detail, by the way, because presumably this is an illusion now, that they've obviously hit water somehow and there's water kind of dripping down the front of it now.
Right.
But you know, and that's why the doctor here is theorizing that, you know, all of this could be an illusion. They might've just blasted the whole top of that thing off and we just can't see it because they're so powerful. So to know that they're putting two and two together and realizing what's really going on. So, I do like the fact that Pike is trying to delve into what the limitations of the Talosian powers are. And he's not, you know, succumbing to what I think. And I, after watching the entire series with Craig, we talked about this many times. We've seen so many starship captains in the original series have been swayed by the power of, you know, leaving their ship and, you know, taking over some planet somewhere and being in charge and kind of losing their minds. And you wonder how many Starfleet captains in this scenario would have just given in and be like, "Oh, I can have whatever I want. Okay, great." Right. I mean,
right.
We've seen so many of them do it. And the only ones we see that don't do it are Pike and Kirk. They're the only ones that can resist.
That's a good point. Yeah. So
fascinating.
Yeah.
And so we're getting some backstory on the Talosians, right? So they lived on the surface and, you know, war-torn society, and they wound up retreating underground and somehow actually became addicted to living vicariously through dreams. And so much so that they forgot everything else. They forgot how to fix, the machines they had, and essentially now all they have left is living through the dreams of people and or creatures that they capture and keep in their zoo, right? So kind of a sad way to live. But there's a little streak of benevolence there as well, isn't there?
You mean on her part?
No, on the Talosian's part.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they know what they're doing is bad. I don't necessarily know if it's if they consider it evil, because I think they really feel like they're giving these people the best possible life scenario they could have by giving them anything that they want. So it's almost like living in the Matrix, right? You take the pill and you go back to sleep and, you know, you're in paradise forever if you buy into it.
Right. So. Well, I think they explore this a little. They're so advanced, I don't think they view humans as any different than we would view a number of different species we would put in a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, obviously as a society, we haven't felt for most of our history too bad about doing it, as long as we believe we're treating them reasonably well, whatever animals we have in a zoo, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, think about it. I mean, if you were in that scenario yourself, I mean, you could be Superman, right? I mean, you right. could really be anything. It sounds kind
of
cool.
Of course, the thing that would creep me out, though, is, you know, you've got all these people watching. So, and it's kind of like that's what the, earlier when she's clinging to him and then she looks up and sees them, she pulls away. You know, it's that you're never really. And maybe so sad, that's kind of signaling it. You're never really free to enjoy it. You realize that you're doing it in service of a bunch of people vicariously watching. You know, you're kind of like a, I guess you could be real blunt and say you're a porn performer in some sense.
Oh,
right?
My God. Yeah, it's
like, I love the effect here where they added
water
to Jeffrey Hunter's tunic there. But it really sort of sells the flames that they superimpose there. I love that shot.
It almost looks like he's melting.
Yeah, that freaked me out as a kid. I remember watching this in the menagerie. That I remember that very well. I heard someone say it's kind of supposed to be wax or molten something or other. You know, he's so.
Yeah, You know, I like the fact that even after being tortured with physical pain, he's still attempting to test their limits, and he says, you know, why, if you want me to eat so badly, why don't you put, you know, the thought of insatiable hunger in my head, and it's because you can't, right? So he's testing right. the limits, even though he knows that you know, he's in a bad spot, but he's still trying to fight his way out. And that's something we see Kirk do in the rest of the series. So that's something else that survives.
Right. He's just made the important discovery here. They can't read through primitive, angry emotion.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why that is.
Well, that's plot convenience.
Right. I know. Yeah. I always look for more than that, Craig. You know me.
Right. Well, I can sort of get on board the idea that when the mind or the, you know, the human body is experiencing an intense emotion, it might throw off the frequencies that it's sending out to, you know, to an alien being.
Good explanation.
How's this? When the id gets ahead of the superego.
Yes.
The, you know, the primitive part gets ahead of the part that's in control. And really what they're accessing is the part that's in control.
Yeah, so it's like garbling or encrypting the message.
Right. Great. Right. I mean, that happens with people even, right? I mean, you know, you flew off the handle and never, you know, afterwards you're like, whoa, what happened there? I didn't see that coming. You know, even yourself, you know. So maybe there you go. That's a reasonable rationalization here.
There you go.
I think we can all agree on that.
Oh, absolutely. Good. Yeah. We explain that one away too.
There you go. So
excellent. And here we are in paradise. And that's, In the background is Pike's hometown of Mojave.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was spectacular.
And I think that detail got lost when they put it in the menagerie, and it's a great detail because that's a desert community in our time, and it's this kind of idea of terraforming, I guess, really.
Yes.
That in the future they've managed to transform even the desert regions of Earth to a verdant, obviously water plentiful paradise.
Yeah.
Here's another sort of Kirk trait that passes over is the, I guess, the love of horses.
Yep.
Yes.
Which is weird because
'60s.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah. I was going to say, which is weird because it always seemed to me like the horse thing was a Shatner thing.
Yep. Not exclusively, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta love that 60s thermos there.
Yeah. And you wonder how many other shows Susan Oliver was on that she wore a very, very similar outfit that she's wearing right now. You know, because she was on Westerns and things, and that looks like a very, you know, Petticoat Junction style blouse and pants that she's wearing, right?
Right. Well, she did 4 wagon trains, by the way.
Yep.
You know, it's funny. I think a lot of, especially younger Trek fans that haven't seen any wagon trains, think of that as a derogatory thing because he sold it as Wagon Train to the Stars, like that was a bad show. It actually was a very good show.
Yes.
It brought some of the best actors available, including Broadway actors. I mean, just fantastic actors. Some of the same that would be the guest stars on Star Trek. And the thing about Wagon Train is it was a vehicle largely for the guest stars. It was by design almost. The guest stars were often there to outshine the regulars. Now that had changed by the time of Star Trek, where the regulars are supposed to be the main focus. But if you got a Wagon Train, that was a showcase for you as a guest star.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's some very good ones. They're not all good, but yeah, there's something like 10 years of them. You can buy them at Fry's and places like that. And they were 36 episode or 32 episode seasons.
Yeah.
So some very good performances out there. I think that sometimes gets missed. Like people think because Roddenberry sold his Wagon Train to the Stars that Wagon Train was bad. And it's not necessarily true.
Yeah. It almost seems, George, like it's sort of like when everybody says it's Die Hard on a bus or it's Die Hard on a plane. You know, it's just a really easy way to sell a concept.
Agreed.
Yep.
Agreed. And how well behaved is this horse, by the way? He just hangs out there. He's not doing anything.
He doesn't even move. No.
No.
No craning of the neck, no chomping at the bit. That horse is stoic.
He would not make the Mr. Ed cut.
No.
Yeah, and here
that
we have
is a Vulcan.
Yeah, we have the explanation of how that land used to be desert.
Yep.
Yeah.
And here I think is a pretty good Jeffrey Hunter performance here, where he's explaining how it's all an illusion and it's just a cage.
Right.
Yeah, and he definitely has the look. You know, he definitely has the captain look. You know, you could buy him as the captain character, just not the captain of the Enterprise because of, you know, what we know of Shatner and how he played the character. But I could definitely see Jeffrey Hunter being the captain of, say, another ship on the show if they had a regular other ship that showed up now and then.
Right.
Because it'd be interesting to see them playing off of each other. They'd be two very different captains.
Right. This is an unfortunate move for him I think it was largely his wife declined the second opportunity to do the second pilot. He decided he was a movie star and not a TV star, and unfortunately his movie career pretty much fizzled and you know he died of a head injury you know in 69, and I think at that point I heard the injury started with something that happened while he was in Italy doing a spaghetti Western or something. But
that's true, George.
He was struggling.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he was struggling. You know, he was on the verge of what could have been something big for him, although I'm not sure how well Star Trek would have done with him.
Yeah.
He might have gotten other chances to be a lead on other TV series. He kind of slammed the door on all that. And yeah, it's unfortunate because he had been a bit of a movie star before this. But that kind of ended for him.
Yeah, it's a shame. So, you know, we just found out, too, by the way, in the context of the show, that Vina has been there for a long, long time. And she says, that, you know, they you know, you can only keep up the hateful thoughts for so long because the Talosians just kept at her and at her for year after year. And now they own her. So that's a little sad bit of future foreshadowing there for what could happen to Pike eventually.
Right. And now, of course, here's the famous scene.
Mm-hmm.
That other guy, one of the unfortunate parts of this is that dialogue they go into, you know. I actually like it when you take advantage of them. It's kind of like you wish that. I was like, oh, yeah, I totally see why they cut this out. But that guy that says some of that, I think he might have even been more of a stuntman than an actor, but he was kind of a guy you'd see a lot in 60s television and made for TV movies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think they entirely cut him out of the menagerie. I don't even think you see that other guy. I can't remember for sure.
Neither can I.
The bald guy for sure. He's there. But
I find it interesting.
Go ahead.
I find it interesting that Pike in this fantasy is the owner of this establishment, and there is another Starfleet guy there wearing like a formal Starfleet captain uniform. So, I mean, I'm wondering.
It is somewhat.
Yeah.
It's a little dismaying about this so-called enlightened view of the future.
Yeah.
You know, he's a slave trader of women, you know?
Is that guy supposed to look like Captain Pike? Is he supposed to look like another version of Pike in this fantasy world? Like, Pike is not himself, and this guy is a duplicate of him or something?
Mm. It's an interesting
take. I just thought it was he's now a slave trader. He runs this place. It's at some kind of a trade outpost. And merchants, the bald guy's a merchant, the other guy's a Starfleet guy, and they just come to his place. He runs a strip club, basically.
And wears very flamboyant clothes.
I heard there was a lot more to that scene. There was even a scene maybe where this slave master was whipping her or cracking the whip
and
crawling around. Yeah, and obviously that stuff did not make the final cut.
You know,
the stuff they had was racy enough.
That actually would explain a little bit better the visceral reaction that we see in those close-up shots of Pike's face, where it looks like he's just getting uncontrollably frustrated. Now, they were meant to be a reaction to someone, you know, whipping or physically abusing her. That makes a little more sense than just, you know, a guy saying some lewd things and she's dancing around.
Mm-hmm. What a look.
Oh,
what
yeah.
a look.
Smoldering.
It's like, say, okay, we're going to do this?
It's smoldering.
Now,
I
one
love
thing,
the way she walks.
Yeah, one thing about this episode is it's got a running time where on a normal episode, we'd be coming up towards the last couple minutes. But this episode runs 1 hour and 3 minutes. There was a substantial amount of editing they would have had to do to this episode to fit it into a regular time slot. I mean, can you guys see ultimately 13 minutes of footage being excised from this?
Oh, I can.
Oh, yeah?
Definitely.
Yeah, they may have been able to. I mean, when you consider the stuff that didn't make it. Here was the trivia question.
Yep, yes, the women.
At the screening. Yeah. I always felt like that's probably the most highly regretted line Leonard Nimoy ever uttered as Spock. He probably thought about that one for years. But, I mean, when you consider the stuff they cut out of these scenes to fit in the menagerie, I think if you made those same cuts, it's still held together as a standalone story.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, George, something that I wanted to ask you, in all of your knowledge about Susan Oliver, did she ever make any statements or say anything in interviews about how iconic the image of her as the Orion slave girl was in the Star Trek universe? I mean, her face was in the credits for so many episodes.
Yeah.
And she became so famous for being the Green Girl. Did she ever make any comments about that?
Not that specifically. I think she, and what's interesting, by the way, I have a lot of her publicity photos that she would sign at autograph events, and she has nothing of her as Venus, or otherwise. She was much more some of her studio headshots and her headshots from Peyton Place. I don't know that she viewed it, because this was just 2 weeks of her life in a very busy, very busy career. And remember, it was on the shelf for 2 years before it ever saw the light of day.
Right.
She might not have even really known, other until she got a residual check, that it had been put into another episode. I know that she did write later that it became, obviously she was aware that the general role was something she was known for. I don't know if it's so much the green slave part of it, but she definitely wrote about it in her autobiography about that it was a special, and it was. I remember this. Before home video, when it was just syndicated reruns, and every, say, 3 to 6 months, it was a very special event. That's what she called it, and she's right. It advertised it in TV Guide, the special two-part menagerie episode, and it got a lot of extra oomph when that was shown in rerun, you know, in the rerun years in the 70s. And she was kind of proud of that. But she never really was so specific as to, oh, I was the original green slave woman. I think it's just another role she played, you know. But she was proud of the fact that overall it was something she was known for, was being on Star Trek. And she was aware of that.
Yeah, I think it's great that it's one of the few things that survived the pilot into the series proper, is the establishment of the Orion alien race and the women in particular. And it was her, the genesis of it was her. And she was the first one. I like the fact that she's part of that legacy. It makes it all the more special. And Spock being the only other character, you know, that makes it out of this episode and into the regular series. So she's a part of a very small group.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about Spock, by the way, because I tried to get Nimoy to give me an interview and I never heard back from him. I think it's quite possible they didn't work together at all on this episode.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's only a brief moment there when they first hit the survivors camp that they're even on the set at the same time, and they're not in a single shot at the same time. So I don't know that they really crossed paths at all. They worked together in other things. They worked together in a wagon train where he played an alcoholic Indian. But
oh, wow.
So it's interesting how TV works, you know, when you really start breaking down shot by shot who worked with who and who didn't, you know. So
yeah, more anger for Mr. Spock here too.
And a bit of fear or freaked out or something, you know. Yeah, he's a bit.
Yeah. Every system is fading out, so
this is cool. This high-speed scan with visual playback. I think it's about to come, right, on the screen. With Kennedy's head and Eisenhower's head and Johnson's head scan by.
Yeah.
This here is actually my favorite scene of this entire episode, where Pike grabs the Talosian and throttles the Talosian on the floor and it attempts to use an illusion to escape. I thought this is a really powerful scene, and it's almost like the final, like the catharsis for the viewers, where, you know, Pike has been essentially helpless the entire time, and now he's finally got a chance. And you're finally seeing some action here.
It's interesting, the empathy from Vina here, right? Don't hurt him. They don't mean to do wrong, you know?
Yeah.
For all they put her through.
Yeah, well, you could almost think it might be like Stockholm Syndrome.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a nice touch.
Yeah. And you can see she has problems with what's going on. She's, you know, got a concerned look on her face whenever they show her there. You know, she looks as if she's very concerned for the welfare of her captor. But she's still, you know, thinking a little bit about how, you know, maybe Pike can assist her in finally overcoming her scenario. But she never does truly give in to that possibility. So she's pretty conflicted.
I did, by the way, when a minute ago, when the other two first beamed down and she gets all catty with them,
mm-hmm.
She's like, you might as well just breed him with a computer. She's pretty.
And here's that sequence, I love George. Yeah.
High-speed scan. And I think it goes as far as Lyndon Johnson's head, because he was president at the time. But supposedly scanning the history of humanity, which is surprisingly consistent with the history of the United States.
Yes. Well, we were talking on our 20th. Season 3 wrap-up about where the timeline from our sort of reality ends and where the Star Trek one begins. And what, Jeff, we pretty much traced it to the late 60s.
Yeah, yep. It pretty much has to be, because that's the only place that the original series writers could have written to. So right. Anything that happens right between, you know, 1969 and, you know, Star Trek era has to be fabricated.
Yeah. But even if you look at them, you know, they set the eugenic wars in the 90s, and obviously they knew that that wasn't going to be our 90s.
True. Exactly. So that's where we have a diversion. But George, you know, I'm glad that you brought up the cattiness, and especially the you might as well breed with a computer, because that's something that I thought was very fascinating about the number one character in the pilot winds up being kind of fused with the science officer character to create the Spock that we know in the in the original series. So you lose the emotions, because in this they don't flesh her out as much. but she's supposed to be very clinical, very logical and computer-like and intelligent in this episode or in this universe. And, you know, that number one character winds up being erased from the ranks and fused with Spock, only to return in the Next Generation. You get the number one character back again. You know, I thought it was fascinating that they, you know, Roddenberry was able to save Nimoy's character by fusing him and creating a brand new character out of two.
That's right. And now you have a cultural / species based reason for this stoicism. So, yeah, I think that's really a good point. And I wanted to mention before, when we were talking about the progressiveness of women's roles in this society, one of the things I think they did well in that regard in this pilot and in the second pilot, and then they revert once the series gets going. I call it the space hooker look, which is kind of how they dress the women once after the two pilots. I mean, they're dressed just like the men in the two pilots, right? They wear tunics and pants. And then suddenly they got to wear thigh-high boots and mini skirts that kind of cover half their rear end. And I mean, as a guy, I like that, but it seems kind of counter to this progressive 23rd century view of women, you know?
Totally.
Exactly.
So, yeah. That's the old skirt hound, if you will, in Roddenberry, I think, mm-hmm. to a degree. And, you know, plus sex sells, you know? I mean, they're trying to get ratings.
So another character device here that we can pick up on that transfers into the Kirk character is the willingness of Pike to sacrifice himself to save the crew of the Enterprise.
Yes.
And we see Kirk do that all the time. And it's a great trait and something I think we all love about Captain Kirk. And I'm glad to see that Pike has that same quality. So it kind of lends some consistency to the Starship captain role.
Right.
Doesn't it?
By the way, I think I like the old rugby / 20s football style jersey uniform tunics a lot better than the later ones. They look comfortable, like you could really get a good, you know, fight in a Klingon bar or something, and they wouldn't be just ripped to shreds like all the ones in the original series ended up being.
Yeah,
they look quite comfortable. Well, I think you saw those same ones in the second pilot, and then they switched uniforms.
Yeah, these are more velour in appearance. They look a little more fuzzy, almost.
Yeah.
So maybe if you took that,
in fact,
and put the black collar on it, and like made a fusion of the two.
I'm not sure they even have all three uniform colors in the pilots.
No, I think it's just gold and blue.
Yeah, I don't think there's an engineering. Yeah. Or security color. Red. Yeah.
That was before guys started buying it just for wearing red every time they beamed down. You know what, by the way, the choice of those three colors, that was very deliberate because they showed distinctly on black and white television.
Oh.
Yeah.
Very
cool.
And
remember, a lot of people, even in 66, are still watching this on black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you could still tell the colors.
Yeah, you could distinguish those colors. You're like, oh, the dark gray guy's going to die. I've never heard of his name before, and he's beaming down. This is not good.
One other interesting note about the uniform colors, and this is a non-canon thing, of course, but if you read the earliest of the Gold Key comics that came out during the time of the original series, the first couple of issues, from what I recall, only have gold and blue uniforms in them. And as such, it's a little tough to tell characters apart. So, you know, the early writing, this was before they had the Star Trek, you know, writing guide. So they kind of based it off of, you know, what the material was that was available. So interesting if you go back and look at them and see the uniforms that they used in those early comics as well.
Yeah. You know, here's a question. Oh, go ahead. This part I never understood. We need to step aside for the beam down. You know, and then this part too, she comes and then she steps down and turns and look, it's the theater of the transporter, you know? Well,
you know, George, earlier you were talking about all of the things that you nitpick through having watched this 50 times. I have one for you right here. Early on in the episode, or actually not too early, but a little bit before where we are now, when the Talosians were threatening the Enterprise, Vina actually says, you know, they can make anybody on the Enterprise push any button they want in such a way that it eventually will destroy the ship, right? So how are they operating the transporter without making anybody press any of the buttons right now?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because they go, oh, the unit's turning on again, and people just appear. No one's pressing any buttons.
Yeah, that's a good question. By the way, there's a little bit of a technical hole here, too, where she talks about, so you got to go back to the original script. Roddenberry envisioned the Talosians as a crab-like, I believe. They were supposed to be crab-like, but it was beyond the technical and budgetary constraints of the show. So he had to get humanoid actors, and they basically look like little humans, right? So her comment here that they'd never seen a human before and they didn't know how to put her back together kind of doesn't fit. I mean, they're humanoid, she's humanoid. They got to know that big-ass hump on one side just ain't right.
Yeah. They got the same basic.
So that really doesn't add up, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe
they've done her where she morphed into an old lady with a big butt head and blood vessels on it. Okay, yeah, now I get it. You know?
Yeah.
They made her look like them.
Maybe the only spare part they had was an extra Talosian head, and they just kind of stuck it on her shoulder.
And this obviously is a rear screen projection, because then they use this to great effect with the Keeper talking to Kirk in the conference room after the trial in the second part of the Menagerie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that part.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was just so amazing that they were able to write that encapsulating two-parter around that and make it work that way. I mean, it was just brilliant.
Yeah.
I think.
And I think it was also somebody looking for a return on their initial investment, right?
Oh, of course. Again, the most expensive pilot ever made. And Roddenberry knew they were literally, apparently, delivering the prints within hours of them going on the air some weeks, because the special effects were so hard and so slow to do.
Wow.
Especially that first season. And he knew they were going to fall behind one week, and I think they did. That's what I've heard anyway. So he knew that we get two episodes for the cost in terms of time and invest, you know, effort of one, just to shoot the encapsulating thing. And we're going to need that in our hip pocket sooner or later. And they did need it.
Yeah.
So that's a little skimpy on the production design in that elevator, by the way. It's just a blank wall, you know, where's that neato window that really sold the moving effect, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So one question for you guys before we close this up, because we're getting right near the end here. And I know this is something that Craig and I probably would normally talk about, so we'll throw this out to you too, George, as well. This seems like another one of those Star Trek stories where if the aliens would have just been honest up front, this thing could have all been avoided. If the Talosian just said, hey, passing Enterprise, we have a little problem down here, and we could use your help in getting our planet back up and running. You know, didn't make any ruse with the illusions or anything. Didn't even have to tell anybody they had those powers. They just said, hey, listen, could you help us out? Starfleet probably been like, yeah, sure. No problem. What do you need? Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, I guess that's not much of a conversation, but
I guess maybe I would bury that under, again, they're so advanced, and maybe there's a certain arrogance that kind of goes over into ignorance on their part.
Good point.
It wouldn't even occur to them to do that. Why would you reach out to an ant colony?
Good point.
And try and have a reasonable discussion, you know?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So this is the end. And then off we go. The Enterprise is flying off into space on its next great adventure.
Sideways gliding off into space. And then, of course, I love this. Catch up with the ship next week. Here it goes this way. Here it goes that way. kind of a
wishful thinking ending to the original pilot,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
So that brings us to the end of The Cage. And so do you either one of you guys have any final thoughts on this episode in general? How about you go first, Craig Cohen?
I, if nothing else, I think it's sort of a great artifact of what something looks like when it's not fully cooked. It's a real sort of peek behind the curtain, if you will, as to really giving us the idea that no great idea jumps out of its creator's head fully formed.
Mm. Excellent, excellent points by you. And George, do you have any thoughts on the cage as a whole, and maybe specifically Susan Oliver's role in this episode?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with what Craig just said. That was a very good insight. Thank God Lucille Ball and NBC and Desi Lu were all willing to get behind this and give it a try. Because it was obviously there was a lot they liked. You know, everyone says how much they did, the network didn't like it, but there was enough there as unheard of to give a series a second shot like that. So they saw something there, and it was just a wonderful thing. And like I've said before, I think it was just obvious that Susan Oliver was the right, there's no writer person to play that part, for lack of a better way of putting it. And it ends up being, ironically, thank God for this, it's one of the few things you easily can access that a lot of people know about her work. It's, you know, one of the few things that wasn't lost in the dust somehow. Most of her work was, and this wasn't. And given that the kind of career she had, of course she was going to have a unique and important imprint on something as important as Star Trek, because she had quite a footprint. Just unfortunately, most of it's been obscured by dust. So, it's just a great artifact on so many levels.
Right on. Well, George, thank you so much for sitting down and chatting the cage with us. This is more fun than I could have imagined when we sort of threw this idea together last year at the convention.
Me too. It was a privilege and an honor to be a part of it. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, absolutely, George. And we look forward to having you back on our series wrap-up in a few weeks to talk about the entire original series as a whole, and maybe some of your favorite episodes and some favorite character moments and things of that nature. So are you signing on to come back with us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just give me the interface time and I'll be there struggling for air as I fumble across the in my space age suit.
Yeah, excellent. No,
I'll be there. I'll be there.
Awesome. We're looking forward to it, George. And everybody out there in listener land, this week was a very special surprise episode here with George talking through the cage. And we have yet another surprise episode coming up for you next Sunday. I don't want to give it away. I think we're going to keep this one a secret too, but very cool to listen into that one and look forward to that. And if you want to catch up with us on Facebook, you can do so at facebook.com/tricordertransmissions, on Twitter at TTT_pod, and our own website at thetricordertransmissions.com. And Craig Cohen and George Pappy, it's been awesome talking to both of you guys.
Right on.
Right on.
All right, and we'll see you next week on the Tricorder Transmissions.
After 16 days shooting at a cost of more than $600,000, the first pilot was over schedule and over budget, and the network gave it thumbs down. But even though NBC didn't like The Cage, they did like the idea of the show, so they asked for an unprecedented second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before. But before that, there was The Cage. Star Trek in its original form.
Oh, again, it would have to be The Cage. It was just perfect Star Trek. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was a creation. The characters were rich. The moments were beautiful. And it was something that he loved dearly. Because it was honest to God, true Star Trek. It had all of the elements that Star Trek ever wanted to have in it. Some of them missed in certain areas, but not The Cage. The Cage was said everything. My first involvement, had to be, of course, with Gene and through Gene. I had known him since 1960, and through a whole mess of pilots and so forth. And then when this one came up, And he had used me, you know, in everything. And so this one came up. He said, here's the chance. So not really, he wrote the part of number one first. And then he said, there, are you happy? He wrote the description of number one, and then he wrote the character. So, I mean, the part was always mine right from the beginning. And then I remember him saying, I want to have a captain and some other people on down. And he said, I want to use an alien. Can you think of a good alien type of person, somebody who's rather angular or so on? And I said, Gene, remember the guy back in when we were doing The Lieutenant that I did the episode with? And he said, yeah. And I said, go back and take a look. That's all I said. That's all I ever mentioned. Never brought it up again. Dissolve. It's about a week or two later, and on the set comes Leonard.
Mr. Spock here.
I was just looking for tall, skinny guys for a Vulcan who had some kind of menace to them. And Leonard was just one of a bunch of guys.
It was kind of funny, you know, to have the second in command first, because that was just my part. He was going to put a woman in there, somehow or other, in command. They came back with all of the tests that said that the public resented a female in the position second in command of a starship, and felt that it was totally unbelievable. They said, this couldn't happen. No woman could handle this part. And that was the end of the story. He said, get rid of her. Gene did not like the idea, of course, but he said he can fight just so much. And, of course, NBC had a lot of other things that they didn't want to either, including the Spock character. So he said that he really desperately wanted to keep the Spock character, because he needed the Spock character. He knew this was going to break my heart. But he said, I've got to drop you, and we'll find something else for you somewhere along the line.
Sorry, number one.
This was my part, so of course I was hurt. But anyway, he decided to do that. He'd keep the number one character. He'd marry the woman, so that because he didn't think that Leonard would have it the other way around.
The network executives thought this episode was too cerebral and that there wasn't enough action. It was too erotic, and they were skeptical about the character of number one. And oh yes. They also hated the guy with the pointy ears. They felt he was too satanic. He'd have to go. But the pilot did prove to the network that you could make a weekly science fiction series that was intelligent, complex, provocative, and believable. Star Trek was on its way.
I've often said that if we had done the series with Jeffrey Hunter as the captain, he was the original captain in the first pilot, I don't think we'd have had the same chemistry. Jeffrey Hunter did not have the, as good an actor as he was, he didn't have the style that Bill Shatner brought to the captain role. Bill's kind of much more aggressive energy made it possible for D. Kelly and I to play the roles that we played, which was kind of a comment on what he was doing, and to play off of that, whereas Jeffrey Hunter was much more internalized and much more thoughtful in his approach to Captain Pike. I think it was a combination of successful elements, good writing and chemistry of the performers that came together to make it possible to do what's now what I think people have enjoyed for years. I have nothing that I would do other than what we did, with the small exception that in the earliest episodes I was stumbling to find my way. There are moments that I wish I could reshoot in the first pilot and in the first and maybe even in the second pilot, in the first two or three or four episodes that we produced. There are moments where I say I was not at home in the character yet. The character had not really found me, or me the character, quite yet. We were still fishing. And later, the character became more centered and more focused and clearer. So if I had it to do again, I'd love to be able to redo some of those first few moments. But other than that, I think it was what it had to be.
So that was how it started. From Gene Roddenberry's mind and an amazing production team came this vision of the future. The series was more than just another television program. Star Trek gave us new forms of science and technology. It gave us new spaceships with new means of propulsion, new aliens, religions, customs, and planets. In short, The Cage created a new galaxy, and the 79 episodes which followed filled it with imagination.